recording? Okay, so this is our first session of The Moon's Lost Light by Devorah Heschlus, and we're going to start with the author's preface. Who should start reading? Anybody? I'll read, okay. Author's preface. Our relationship with our Creator is the deepest and most important one that we have. It existed before we were born and will continue to exist after our deaths. Human relationships can sour. People we believe in can disappoint us, and those we love most, can die. But no matter what happens in life, the Creator is always there with us. It was this relationship with their Creator that kept Jews going through the most difficult trials. It was so strong that throughout our history, Jews sacrificed themselves out of loyalty to and love for their Creator. But what happens to a person's relationship with the Creator if one feels that his laws are not loving and just? What happens to a woman's relationship with the Creator if she feels that women are his stepchildren, so to speak? Of course, we can keep the Torah out of fear alone, knowing that we have no choice because the Creator is all-knowing and all-powerful, and that the time will come when we will have to give an account before him for all we have done. We also have a moral obligation to serve Hashem for having created us and given us life. This is the concept of Kabbalas Ol Malchus Shemayim, the acceptance of the yoke of the kingdom of heaven, which means that we accept whatever Hashem wants of us unconditionally, and that is a basic tenet of Judaism. Just so you know, this author is a Hasidish woman, mother of 14, living in Jerusalem for the last 30 very many plus years. But fear or obligation alone is not enough. Hashem wants us to serve him with love. And as the Kedushas Levi on Pesach points out, our love of Hashem comes from knowing that he loves us. Similarly, he wants us to serve him joyfully, as it says, Ivdu es Hashem b'simcha, serve Hashem in joy. That is why I think that understanding the women's issue is so important. Some people don't have a problem with the women's issue. They focus on all the positive things about the Torah's attitude towards women, and they're satisfied with this. But it doesn't work that way with everyone. After all that has been said about this subject, there are still points with which some women and men as well find, very disturbing. And that is my main reason for writing the work before you. People have often tried to explain the Torah's precepts according to their own way of thinking, but the reasons given are not necessarily the Creator's. However, the major sources used for this book are from the deeper level of Torah known as Chachmas HaEmes, the wisdom of truth. The root of this wisdom is in prophecy, or Ruach HaKodesh, and so reveals Hashem's ideas, not man's. Of course, there is much more to this matter than I am writing here, for the Torah is endless. I can only share with the reader that part which Hashem in his kindness has allowed me to discover. My hope is that this will be enough to remove the Chil Hashem that has come about in this area and replace it with Ahavas Hashem. Nevertheless, this book isn't candy. It won't always taste sweet. Instead, it is a true human saga of tests, failures, and triumphs, opportunities tragically lost, which will eventually be regained. But although there is pain in this story, there's also joy, because one can see Hashem's truth and justice in it, and because in the end, evil will disappear, and with it, all external inequality. At that time, we will bless Hashem for the bad, just as we now bless him for the good. For we will understand that it was all for the good all along. Now for a personal note. The Talmud Yerushalmi in Maseches Makos, page 7b, tells us that one is not allowed to accept honor for having studied more Torah than one actually has. Since there are a wide range of sources cited in the references, the reader might assume that the writer is extremely learned. This is not so. The fact that I found what I needed to write this book and that I was able to make the necessary connections was a heavenly gift, Siyata Dishmaya. The Sfas Emes explains that the four sons of the Haggadah exist within all of us. When speaking of the Tam, the simple son, he says that it may sometimes happen that we receive a deep enlightenment as a heavenly gift. People will ask, Mazos, what is this? Where did it come from and how did it happen? The answer is, Bechozek Yad Hotzi'enu Hashem Mitzrayim. Hashem took us out of Egypt with a strong hand. The Hebrew word for Egypt, Mitzrayim, actually means a narrow, confined place. The Sfas Emes explains But the answer is that Hashem took us out of our narrow, confined thinking with a strong arm, meaning that he did it himself. We didn't do it. It was simply a heavenly enlightenment given to us as a chesed from above. I found in this explanation of the Sfas Emes an accurate description of my own experience. So that's interesting. So she's just making it very clear that she acted as a channel and not, this is not a reflection of her deep knowledge. Okay. Any questions so far on any of that? Discuss any of that? Okay. Introduction. There have been many. Do you want to sit over here so you can see the words?
Well, that's okay.
Is listening okay?
Okay,
good. Introduction. There have been many good books written about the women's role in Judaism. If the reader is uninitiated, I highly recommend reading them, for they give important insights into this issue. This work, however, has a different purpose. It is meant to answer the following questions. Why do women sometimes appear to have a secondary position in Judaism? Why are there some rabbinical descriptions of women that don't seem to correspond to the reality we know? Why is it that until the modern era, Jewish women had more rights and respect than women in other societies, yet now the situation seems to have been reversed? Western society endorses total gender equality, while Torah society has been placed on the defensive. The reader might find the conclusions presented here surprising and unusual, but I hope also truthful and inspiring. They are based on information drawn from the deeper dimensions of Torah, the Targum Yonasan, the Kli Yakar, the Vilna Gaon, Sfas Emes, Mechtav Meliahu, and many others. Here are found many secrets beyond the changes of the modern era, the turbulent pre-messianic period known in Chazal as Ikvisa de Meshicha, the footsteps of the Messiah.
This is so stupid, yeah, it's what not, is not Chazal?
Okay, such an important question. Write it in Hebrew. Chet Zayin Chupchik Lamed. You need to write it out.
Okay.
It's an abbreviation. Chet Zayin Zayin Chupchik Lamed. Chazal. Right? Chet Zayin.
Zayin is this.
Uh-huh.
Okay, Lamed.
Chachamim Zichronam Livracha. Chachamim Zichronam Livracha. Our sages of blessed memory.
Okay.
That's what it means, and it refers to Mishnaic and before sages, maybe Gemara and before sages.
Chachamim
Zichronam Livracha.
Livracha.
Our sages of blessed memory. That's what it means. Our sages of blessed memory. Chachamim or Chachamenu, either one, because it's the same chet. Chachamim or Chachamenu Zichronam Livracha. Zal. Sometimes we say Zal after a person's name.
Yeah.
Right? My father Zal. My father's still living, but you know, somebody might say. Or Rabbi so-and-so Zal. Right. His memory should be for a blessing.
Yeah.
Zal. Okay, so this is, so that's a very important question. Chazal is often capitalized like it is here in English. Chazal. And that refers to our sages. It does not refer to our sages of late. So we would not call Rabbi Moshe Feinstein or Rabbi Dessler or the Chafetz Chaim Chazal. They're not counted in Chazal.
So these are the sages of the first and second and third century.
Yes, and before.
Aramim and the Tanaim.
Right, 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 right. Right.
Amorim.
Exactly. Amoraim. Amora is singular. Tana is singular. Amoraim, plural. Tanaim, plural. Amoraim are the sages of the Gemara. Tanaim are the sages of the Mishnah. So those different periods. So, and they would be referred to as Chazal. Although she is also bringing books that are not Chazal, so she may be using it just in the wider, right? Because Sfas Emes, Vilna Gaon, Mechtav Meliahu, Targum, oh, none of those are Chazal level, but they are bringing Chazal secrets.
So it's noteworthy to know that she's really used some very, very good sources.
Yes.
You know, and
yes, so these are all. So the Sfas Emes was the Ger Rebbe, the first Ger Rebbe, the Vilna Gaon. Was considered by those in the Kabbalistic circles to be the last new neshama born into the world. It's interesting to think about him as that. But he was a mystic. Mechtav Me'Eliyahu, that's Rabbi Dessler. Eliyahu Dessler. He's referred to by his book, The Letters of Eliyahu, but that's Strive for Truth, is a just a sum of his letters, but he has a full set. So he's explains philosophy in a way that we can understand today. Targum Yonasan, not quite sure. Kli Yakar, also an older commentary. So those two are older commentaries. I wish I could tell you exactly where they're from. But Terry Samuel, she should live and be well and keep learning and learning and learning and learning. She's amazing. She could definitely tell you who they are and when they lived. She's amazing. She just learns it and remembers it. You know, my husband now says that, he says, referring to himself, he says, my mind is like a steel trap, just one that's been left out in the rain and rusted open. So, so hers is a steel trap that closes and grabs it, right? Yeah. Okay. Some people reading this book have described it as speaking of women's changing roles, but I wouldn't put it that way. Women were meant to be the bais, the home, the bait, right? The life and spirit of the Jewish home. And that is just as true today as it ever was. What this book speaks of is women's enriched role. Interesting. As explained within, woman was created on a very high spiritual level, but she subsequently lost part of her light. The great light will return in messianic times. To get an idea of what this means, imagine Sarah Imenu. Chazal tell us that she was a sage and a prophetess on a very high level, but that in no way diminished her role as wife and mother. If this sounds complicated, well, it is somewhat. This book was not written for people who think that Hashem must give them instant gratification. It is meant to help sincere Jews who want true answers to these questions. There's a lot of information condensed into this small work, and much of it might be new to the reader. I therefore hope you'll have the patience to go through it carefully so that important points won't be missed, or worse yet, misunderstood. What is written here is not meant to serve as a practical guide, nor does it in any way propose to influence halacha. Its purpose is to provide understanding to enable us to accept Hashem's Torah with love, as it says in the blessing before the Shema, and give our hearts understanding to understand and to have intelligence, to hear, to learn, to teach, to guard, and to do all the words of your Torah with love. It is my fervent hope that the following essay will help towards that goal. With this in mind, that's some of my frustrations with some of the women who are pushing boundaries outside of halacha, because it's not about going outside halacha. It's about figuring out how to work inside, deeply inside halacha, to really magnify the impact of women in a Torah way, not in a non-Torah way.
But I think that this whole book is really kind of addressing, you know, this obviously was written before Sarah Horowitz became a rabbi.
Right.
But just that the Western, the petri dish that we find ourselves in at this time in the world history of Jews is such that women, because she's going to go into this, really feel that they need to push the boundaries because they don't understand.
Exactly. So that's what I'm saying. Right. It's exactly what I'm saying. And that's what this book is for, because she certainly is writing post the formation of Women of the Wall, and post reform and conservative ordination of women, and post, within the context of a world living in Israel where there's women's Torah readings and there's women dancing with the Sefer Torah at the Kotel and things like that. She's definitely writing within that context. Mm-hmm. So she definitely sees that and is writing to that, saying, women, many of us feel like second-class citizens. They won't give us a safer Torah to dance with. We can't have an aliyah. We can't how can we feel like we, you know, you can be a doctor or a lawyer or a congressman, but you can't be a rabbi? Like, what is that? Mm-hmm. You know, how backwards are we? So that's what she's trying to come and teach, is that there's something much deeper than the petri dish in which we find ourselves. Much deeper than that. And I think that's what's so important to recognize, that we come from a very deep place, and the petri dish is always changing in every generation, right? So, you know, when do we respond and when don't we? We're always influenced by it. But when do we respond halachically because of it is a different question, right? So that's what we'll look at.
She's the only one who has taken up this subject to bring it to the forefront?
She is the only one who's written about it like this. Many other people have written different books about a woman's role in Judaism. So Tzipora Heller has Our Bodies, Our Souls, I think, because that's a parallel title to Our Bodies, Ourselves, which is a feminist manifesto. So this is Our Bodies, Our Souls. So Tzipora Heller wrote that. And then there's quite a few other books. One of them is, it's a very long title, it's a relatively recent, like 6-year-old book, I think, maybe 10. Why Should I Be Standing Behind the Mechitza When I Could Be Leading the Prayer Service? That's the name of the book, something like that. And then there's other books. Lisa Aiken's To Be a Jewish Woman. She writes a lot about the woman's role in Judaism. And then there's little sprinkles here and there. There's the halachic book, Halichot Bat Yisrael. That's a two-volume book that just really goes through the halachas. And then there's Rav Getzel's three-part book, The Woman in Halacha. And that really is also just halachas and some hashkafic points, but it's not a digested treatment of philosophic underpinnings of why women behave are treated in certain ways. Halacha.
So which is what she does.
That's what she's doing.
Yeah. She also mentions Rachel Adler. For some reason, but maybe not. Maybe similar.
I mean, those are some books that just treat different things. So, all right, so this is going to really start. It's so interesting. There's so much interesting stuff here in here. All right, shall I keep reading it? Somebody else want to read? Okay, great. Okay, chapter one, The Moon's Lost Light. One of the foremost issues in Jewish life today is the Torah's attitude towards women. Much has been written and said on the subject, but for many it still remains a sore point. Throughout the generations, the Jewish woman was accorded more rights and respect than women in any other society. Suddenly, the situation seems to have been reversed. General Western society has declared equal rights for women, while Torah society has been placed on the defensive. What is the meaning of this? Are men and women equal according to Torah, or are they not? Some will answer an emphatic yes, while others will answer just as emphatically, no. This is because there's evidence pointing in both directions. What makes matters even more difficult for our generation to understand is that Talmudical and later rabbinical writings often describe women in a manner which does not correspond to the reality we know. For example, most women are portrayed as capable of excelling in practical pursuits, but incapable of abstract study. That would be the... look at that source. That's where it's Datan Kalot.
It's really important to read the notes, by the way.
Yeah, okay, so let's make sure we do that.
There's so much stuff in the notes.
There is really a lot in the notes. Yeah, so we definitely want to be looking at notes as we go through. All right, so note number one, the Yerushalmi on Mishnah Sota 3:4, Maseches Menachos 1:10, the Rambam Hilchos Talmud Torah, chapter 1, Mishnah 13. Among others. So all of those, we really should be looking them all up. That would be our smart thing to do.
Now, pardes, we would do that.
Right. Well, so that's our choice. If we want to start bringing in things and looking them up, we can do that. Maybe we should start doing that. If we want, it depends on what we want to do. We could even go through the whole thing once, just reading it, and then bring in stuff.
Bring in the sources.
If we want to go deeper. That's definitely the way to get more skills in learning. We can think about that. But meanwhile, those three sources we just know point to different places where women are described as not having the type of knowledge that could adequately study Torah with depth. Correspondingly, women were generally occupied with sewing, housework, practical childcare, and possibly a small business. But until the modern era, most women were not involved with abstract learning of any sort. And yet we see that women today do succeed and even excel in many areas that require abstract understanding, including the most important one, Torah study. How can we understand this contradiction? Since the Torah was written for all generations, the answer to these questions must be found in the Torah itself. To reach them, however, we must delve more deeply into the Torah's teachings. I think that's so important, and that's what bothers me about so many groups, because a lot of people will just say, okay, so whatever's in the way of my values today, let's kick it out of the way, rather than saying, okay, let's go deeper. It's definitely there. We just have to dig much deeper to find it.
But just as a point of interest, a lot of these notes are Kabbalistically oriented.
So that's bizarre. Much deeper, right.
And, I mean, you have to do big, big-time study to really...
Which is why she said she doesn't want you to think that she, but she is.
Yeah, I mean, but...
She's clearly a Talmidei Chachama, there's no question about that. Yeah. Is she of the greatest of the generation? No, she's not that either, but that's what she wants to say. I'm going to be touching on Kabbalah here. Don't think I'm a Kabbalist. I'm not. Mm-hmm. You know, and I totally understand what she's talking about. I mean, here I teach Torah. Am I a big scholar? I'm not. I love to learn, and definitely most of what I teach is blessed by Hashem, but I'm just the conduit for the bracha. You know, it's not me. So that's what she's saying here, too. She has more of a bracha than I do. I mean, her Hebrew is good. She has the generations. She has a husband who can help her. Like, she has that. And so she's been able to access deep places. But she wants to be clear that she's not a capitalist, and it doesn't belong to her. She's channeling it for us, right? So
she either knew people to go to ask, where do I find this?
Absolutely, absolutely. She doesn't have she doesn't have the breadth of knowledge to know all these places herself, but she has the level of curiosity and desire to seek it, and have learned it. So she's definitely put that effort into it. It's not like it was, you know, a straight channeling. She's not a medium. She went into a trance and the book came out. You know, she definitely.
Well, she's going to give us basically a gloss. You know, I mean, this is deep, but this is a gloss. And yet, to really, really understand the whole idea of the difference between men and women, I mean, you have to study years and years. I mean, and it's very Kabbalistic. And really
very Kabbalistic.
And so, don't beat yourself up.
Right. No, but I think that's important to understand, too. And why do we have access to Kabbalah today that we did not have earlier?
Because we need it. Generation thing with the women.
Exactly. Yeah. We definitely need it. Mm-hmm. So that's why, yes, we're in different petri dishes every generation, every 10 years, especially today. Forget, like every 5 years. Mm-hmm. Just in buying this new car, I'm thinking, this is going to be obsolete in 5 years. It's got half smart stuff in it. You know, like, it's like a phone now. Like, how fast do you have to discard a car?
Every year.
Like, forget about it. So, you know, every year, like, life is changing so much, not like in the olden days where people could be born into a world that they expected to die in. We don't expect to wake up tomorrow in the world that we went to sleep in. It's different so fast. So, nevertheless, there are deep, deep roots that are unchanging. And that's what we want to tap into, because those roots, what looks like changes to us, are not. They're just the flowering of those roots, right? So what's been growing all along, we now see different parts. What used to be root is now stem. What used to be stem is now leaf. What used to be leaf is now bud. And what used to be bud is now like opening up. But it's all from the same place. So we could say change, but not really if we get it, right? So that's what we want to see. Mm-hmm. That's why we're going to Kabbalah, to really see the roots and where it's coming from. Okay, let's see. Some people might be bothered that there are ideas in this work which stem from Kabbalah, not us, though. There is, however, a major difference between studying Kabbalah directly and studying what we call Pnimiyas HaTorah, the teachings taken from Kabbalah which have been prepared or approved by tzaddikim for the Jewish masses. That's us, the Jewish masses, who will be looking at some of the innerness of the Torah that's based on Kabbalah but not actually Kabbalah. So we're not studying Kabbalah, we're just studying what's been approved for us. Although only someone on a very high level of purity and Torah knowledge may study Kabbalah directly, it is beneficial for all Jews to learn ideas whose source is in Kabbalah, but which have been prepared for laymen. The commentaries of the Orach Chaim and the Kli Yakar, which are printed in the standard Mikraos Gedolos Chumashim, that's the standard Chumash that most people have on their shelves in Hebrew. If you have a regular Hebrew Chumash, Mikraot Gedolot, and you'd probably recognize that page set up with the different commentaries. It's got Chumash, Unklus, Rashi, and then a bunch of different
ones. Right, Gemara.
Yeah, but that's a standard Chumash that most people have. Includes the commentaries of the Kli Yakar and the Sfas Emes and a few different ones, which means that that's approved for the masses. You're allowed to look there. The Gaon of Vilna brought many ideas from Kabbalah into his writings for laymen. This is also true of the Chafetz Chaim. His classic Shmiras HaLashon quotes extensively from the Zohar and brings other Kabbalistic teachings, such as Gilgulim, reincarnations. These books were written for all Jewish readers. With this understanding, let us now begin. So, meaning we can't approach some of this stuff. Okay, diminishing the moon. Our sages take us back to the beginning of the world of world history. There is a passage in the Gemara concerning the feminine role, which is both poignant and startling. Rabbi Shimon ben Pazi asked, "It is written, and God made two big luminaries, and yet it is written, the big luminary and the small luminary. If they're both big, why is one later called small?" Let's just say where that is. That's in the creation of the world, right? In the very beginning of the Chumash, when God is setting up the world, right? So it says, "And he made two great lights." That's the Pasuk. And the very next sentence is the great one to rule the day and the small one to rule the night. So you have to ask, if it's two great lights, where do we get a great one and a small one? You just said two great ones, and now there's a big and a small? So there's a midrash right in the middle there, right? The midrash comes to answer these questions. That's what this Gemara is talking about. The diminishment of the moon, right? So how did the moon...
How did it happen?
How did it happen? That's what's happening here. That's what we're going to discuss. That's what this whole book is about.
Is that midrash in the book of Midrashim?
It may be in the Gemara. I mean, that may be its source. I'm not quite sure if you'll find it in the Midrash Rabbah.
Mm-hmm.
This is Ein Yaakov. Well, Ein Yaakov is part of the Gemara.
Right.
Ein Yaakov is girl Gemara.
Right, I know.
Right?
But we study this.
Right, because it's not halachic. Ein Yaakov is a gadik. So that's why it's called girl Gemara. It's not really. Ein Yaakov is not written for women. It's the place where women are allowed to look at Gemaras. So those women who are very careful not to look inside a Gemara because they're not supposed to learn Gemara, will learn a piece of Gemara that's relevant to them from the Ein Yaakov, because it's not Gemara. That's why I said it's girl Gemara, but it's not really. The Ein Yaakov is a collection of the non-halachic parts of the Gemara, right? Which this is not halachic, but we'll see has halachic ramifications later on.
What does the first word
mean? Ein Yaakov. Ein Yaakov. So it's Ein with an Ayin, not with an Aleph.
Ein Yaakov. It was after the rabbi that wrote it.
Well, so his name is Yaakov, right? But the reason I'm saying Ein with an Ayin, that means spring, as opposed to Ein with an Aleph, which means not.
Okay.
Right? So it's the wellspring of Jacob.
Wellspring.
But it's just called the Ein Yaakov. The Ein Yaakov. So the Ein Yaakov is a pretty thick book. That's a coffee table sized book, you know, that thick and that big, not this sized. It would be like 3 volumes or 4 volumes. Not quite as big as the Gemara, but it's like a thick...
For women only.
It's all midrash.
It's all agadic.
Agadic.
It's all agadita.
But parts of it are in the Gemara. I mean, you look in the Gemara.
Well, it's all Gemara.
It's all Gemara, but it's...
Right, so the Gemara is divided into two main categories. One is halacha, and it's laws, and one is agadita, stories. Stories that teach stuff, important things. So that you might call it midrash, you might call it agadita, and I don't know enough Gemara to be able to divide the agadic sections into minor categories. But so it might be midrash, it might be when is it called midrash, when is it called agadita, when is it called all those different things, and what do they all mean in their details? I don't know. But the Ein Yaakov is the collection of the non-halachic parts of the Gemara. And that is where it's not collected for women. It's collected so that you could easily look it up that way. But it is where women would look if a woman was careful not to look inside a Gemara. For those
halacha, you would think that women need to learn the halacha.
No, so women. So nobody looks at the Gemara for halacha lama'aseh. Halacha lamaisa.
So this is all done through oral.
So halacha lamaisa or halacha lamaase, those are the two different ways to pronounce it, means practical, applicable halacha of today. So even if you would see in the Gemara, and there are straight practical things, like for instance, where you can pray if you're walking on the road, can you pray in a ruins, can't you pray in a ruins, right? So even if the Gemara would say you cannot, it doesn't mean that you can't today. You have to look in the codes of Jewish law for today. So the Gemara, so really, that was one of the big controversies with the Rambam. The Rambam rewrote the Gemara in a way, and he codified it in his Mishneh Torah into all practical halacha. You don't have stories in the Rambam. So the Gadita's out, and the whole Rambam, the Mishneh Torah, is written 14 volumes, going through all the halachic parts and rendering decisions and telling you when you read the Shema, how much you have to say, when did you transgress on this, what does it mean, can you do business with an idol worshiper 3 days before their holiday because you might be giving them money to buy a sacrifice for their idol, so should you, shouldn't you? Like, he goes into all of that, right? What can you buy from them, what can't you buy from them, what wine can you drink, what wine can't you drink, how do you keep Pesach, you know, what's a Hillel sandwich, all that stuff, how do you do it? That's what the Rambam wrote. And he thought, when he wrote that, that would the study of his Mishneh Torah would replace the study of Gemara. Mm-hmm. It didn't, because the study of Gemara is about, it's also about developing your mind in a different way. It's not about getting the practical legal ramifications of it. So while women absolutely have to have practical halacha in their lives and need to learn it, and usually we learn it from teacher to student, mother to daughter, or sometimes somebody else to daughter, and that worked until the 1700s when it started to break down, which is why in the 1800s they started schools for girls. But it worked, transmitted, really female to female mostly, throughout all the generations until about the 1700s. They for sure have to have practical halacha, no question about it. Do they need Gemara for it? Absolutely not. Right? So it's sort of like saying, like, Not that it's the same, and I don't understand enough about math, but you'll figure out your own muscle for this, your own, she's a math person. For sure, we all need addition and subtraction. We need division and multiplication, too, and we even need fractions, right? And division and multiplication of fractions so we can cook, right? We all need that. And so, we all need that. Do we all need abstract math so that we can understand that in our practical lives? Do we need the study of math? Well, no, although yes, we do teach pretty regularly algebra to everybody because the thinking helps us. Nobody needs algebra. Few people need algebra in their daily lives, right? But it's good to expose most people, which is why we do in this country, to algebra and geometry because it does change how you think a little. And so while you don't need the math, most people, you do need the ability to think differently. So the practical was definitely taught to women. The how to think a little differently by learning Gemara was not. And women didn't need it. Now, women can do it for sure. So that's what we're looking at here. So anyway, this is Agadata, which you could find in Ein Yaakov, which is the story, which is based on this question that's between the verses in the Torah. Now there's a question mark, right? Whenever you see something, an anomaly like that, two great lights, and now one is big and one is small, what happened to two great? This is going to come in and answer that question, which is going to be very esoteric, the answer, and that's what the whole book is going to discuss. This weird thing in the verses and how it applies, okay? Okay, so if they're both big, why is one later called small, right? The moon said before the Holy One, blessed is he, master of the world, two kings cannot share one crown. He said to her, right? Now the moon is being called feminine. He said to her, go and make yourself small. So she's bringing a complaint to God. How could there be two kings with one crown? Whatever that means, we don't even know what that means. Two kings with one crown? Why can't they have two crowns? Why can't there be two kings with two crowns? But anyway, he said to her, go make yourself small. And she said, because I said something proper before you, I should make myself small? Is that fair? And he said to her, go rule by day and by night. She said to him, what's the advantage in this? What is the value of a candle at noontime? So he says, don't worry, you're going to be around the whole time, day and night. And she's like, really? If I have to make myself small, you can't even see me in the day. What's the value of a candle at noon, right? That's who I'll be. That's not fair. She's ticked off, right? So she says, he said to her, go so that Israel may count the days and the years through you. She said to him, the sun is also necessary for counting the times and the seasons, as it says, and they, both the sun and the moon, will be signs and appointed times. They will be for signs and appointed times. So she says, that's not special. You're not giving me a consolation prize by saying that we'll count time through me. Like, the sun also gets that. Not fair. Go, that righteous ones will be called by your name, right? You're the Katan, because she's now the small light, the Katan. It says, don't worry, you'll see there's also going to be other Katanim in history who will be famous, like Yaakov HaKatan, Shmuel HaKatan, David HaKatan. So you'll be among that group of the Katans who are really great. Mm-hmm. And she says, he saw that she's still upset. The Holy One, blessed is he, said, bring an atonement for me that I diminished the moon. So now an offering has to be brought on Hashem's behalf at Rosh Chodesh to appease the moon, which is weird because we know that when you appease somebody, you bring the offering, you give the gift, after you fix the problem. You don't like stick somebody and while you're sticking them say, please forgive me and here's a present. First you have to unstick, right? And he didn't yet, right? So that's what Rabbi Shimon ben Lakish said. What is different about the great offering of the new moon?
Of the goat.
Oh, what is different about, thank you, about the goat offering of the new moon, that the term for God is used regarding it? The Holy One, blessed is he, said, the goat will be an atonement for my having diminished the moon. So, but still, okay, so this is a very strange thing. The moon comes to him with a proper question. God says, you're right, there can't be two great lights. You make yourself smaller. She says, and so he tries a bunch of things to give her a consolation prize, not interested. And so in the end, he says, an atonement will be brought every Rosh Chodesh for God, on God's behalf, to the moon. We're not, I'm like, what is that? Right? It's a very strange thing. We for sure don't believe that God gives an offering to anything or needs to. And we for sure don't believe that the moon has a personality that it needs an offering by anything. Right? We don't believe that a conversation like this happened because moons don't talk. Right? So the question is, what is going on here? This is all very Kabbalistic.
How could the moon make itself smaller if it...
And how could the moon make itself smaller? So obviously
it wasn't created by itself.
It doesn't, right. No, it was not created by itself and it didn't make itself smaller. So the whole conversation is just to be used as a way for us to discuss feminine energy. That's what the whole thing is about, is feminine energy. Right? So that's what we're going to discuss. It's a whole Kabbalistic thing. It has nothing to do with the moon and the sun. It's just that the sun is considered masculine. The moon is considered feminine. Anybody who's read any of Akiva Tatz's stuff to this point will see parallels there in that the sun is a giver of light and the moon is a receiver of light. The moon has no light of her own. She can only shine to the extent that she receives the light of the sun. So in that sense, with masculine energy being giving energy and the feminine energy being receiving energy, the sun parallels the masculine and the moon parallels the feminine. But we do see a diminishment, certainly, because the sun shines more brightly than the moon, even if the moon receives as much as possible. Even at a full moon, it doesn't shine like the sun does. So clearly, the moon is lesser than the sun, not only in receivership, but in brilliance. So what is that? So this whole thing is all to talk about masculine and feminine energies and what's going on. Okay. The Gemara obviously cannot be understood on a superficial level. God does not need an atonement from human beings. However, there is a rule that passages such as these are speaking of how things are perceived by people. A parallel in our lives would be when a nurse inoculates a baby who then cries out in anger and pain. The sympathetic nurse says to the baby, "You're right, poor thing." What she means, of course, is not that the baby's objectively right, but rather that from the baby's limited understanding, he is right. The nurse's action seems totally unjust. What can we learn from this Gemara? Much has been written about it, but in this essay we will deal with only one aspect of the Agada, women's secondary position. The Gemara tells us that the sun and the moon were originally created equal, but that the moon was later diminished. The moon, which in Hebrew is called Levana, contains the word lev, heart. The sun is called chama, which contains the word moach, brain. That would be if you mix around the letters. The Michtav Meliyahu Rav Dessler says about this, "The two great lights allude to two ways in which a person can grasp Hashem Yisparach, Hashem may he be blessed, light, through the intellect and through the heart. In the unblemished world, as Hashem originally wanted it to be, the intellect and the heart are equal powers and work together, and everything which the intellect grasps enters the heart immediately and completely." Let's see what the source is. That just tells you the letter, which letter, Michtav Meliyahu 4, page 207, if you want to look that up. In other words, both of these powers are equally important. For although it is essential to know the truth intellectually, the Torah's goal is to have the truth in our hearts. The Michtav Meliyahu goes on to say that the moon thought it should be the greater of the two because it wanted the world to respect the internal surface of Hashem, the surface of the heart, more than the intellectual achievement. Let's just stop there for a minute and think about what we have around. We do see those who are able to achieve intellectual heights where it doesn't touch their heart at all. They're not a mensch, right? We've definitely seen that. And we definitely see people who are not learning at all who really get it. They're so kind. They're so giving. They're so sharing. They would never say a bad word about anybody like that. So they totally get it, right? Without any study. So, and the Torah does want it to end in, to go to our hearts, but the Torah wants it to go through our brains. So that it should be both. Because it turns out that hearts, although it's very strong, can be turned on and turned off, right? And the intellect has more stable presence. So while people may come to Torah, and often women have a faster path to becoming observant if you take a male and a female who are both, let's say, raised in non-observant homes, and they both choose to become observant, usually the female will go much faster because her heart leads her. And she gets it, and she's willing to take that. She'll go faster heart-wise, and then does need to take the time to build up intellectual underpinnings, or her heart can turn off, like falling in and out of love. Right? I mean, you can't just say, I don't like this so much anymore. And then you're gone. Whereas if you take the intellectual path, it can be much slower. The guy can take 2 or 3 years, 4 or 5 years before he makes a commitment. But when he makes it, it's there. It's solid because he took all that time. So to make it intellectual and then let it go into his heart. So, but it, really the Torah wants it in the heart, just strong, so it won't disappear. I actually just heard of somebody just asked me a question, which I hadn't heard before, but makes sense. He said, have you ever heard of a convert who feels that when they convert to Judaism, God owes them certain things, and that if God doesn't hold up his end of the bargain, then they have by rights they can leave? And I said, not really, although I could imagine such a situation. I said, because we just heard of somebody who did that, like they converted, they were from for a few years, and then they took off and now they're teaching English in Asia somewhere. But the reason why he felt he was entitled to take off is because he felt like God didn't meet his promises. So it's interesting to me because I feel like that's one reason why we have raised the bar higher for converts today, is because you have to be chutzpahdik and you have to be tenacious to be a Jew. You have to be, right? God made us promises, but we're waiting a very long time to see them fulfilled. You have to be very long-suffering. You have to know there's a promise, you have to buy into the promise, and then you have to have a lot of patience and not expect that you're going to see any results, maybe even in your lifetime, but certainly not in a few years. So if you don't have that, you can't be Jewish. Like,
but I would think that this is the wrong premise to start with.
Yeah, as soon as the person said that, I said, I don't necessarily blame the person. Right, I blame his rabbis who converted him because clearly they did not delve deeply enough.
This is not the right.
I mean, you have to know, like, how much should a rabbi be looking in? Like, it's really a question. Like, when do you accept a convert and when don't you? But clearly that's a person who had absolutely deep misunderstandings of what the whole process is about and what you get if you join. Right? What you get if you join is, you know, a relationship with God, but a yoke, right? And you got to carry it, and it's heavy, and that's what it is. And, you know, so hopefully you're excited enough about the program that it's worth it to carry the yoke. But if you think that you put the yoke on and then, you know, life is going to open up, well, just look around you. Right. Anyway, so that's the problem with hearts. Hearts turn on and turn off. Okay. In other words, both of these powers are equally important, for although it's essential to know the truth intellectually, the Torah's goal is to have the truth in our hearts. The Mechtav Me'eleahu goes on to say that the moon thought it should be the greater of the two because it wanted the world to respect the internal service of Hashem, the service of the heart, more than the intellectual achievement. The Zohar tells us that the Levana, the moon, represents woman. For Zohar 1. Yeah, so those are Zohar sources, which I'm not capable of looking up. That's an Aramaic, which I hope to learn, but I don't know yet. Because most women's main gift, so most women's main gift, not all, lies in emotional understanding. Men are represented by the Chama, the sun, because generally speaking, man's gift is his intellectual power. This does not mean that women have no intellect or that men have no heart, of course. Obviously, both sides must have both powers, as mentioned in note 172. We could even read that. Hang on, I'll read this, finish the sentence and then read the note. As mentioned in note 172, the Hasidic commentary to Tiferes Shlomo says that every person has both male and female personality traits. So let's just read that note. Tiferes Shlomo on Sukkos, the Ushpizin on Yosef, says, and in each and every one of the Jewish people, there is an aspect of Mashiach ben Yosef and Mashiach ben David, as is explained in the Kabbalistic books. And it is the aspect of male and female, as it says, male and female, he created them. And the Sfas Emes on Vayigash 56:60 says that Yehuda, from whom David is descended, is the heart. while Yosef is the brain. This corresponds to the idea that Malchus, which is considered feminine, is the heart, while Yosef is a male type and therefore the brain. Both are necessary in everyone. Okay. Rather, it means that one's strongest tool to connect properly to God and life is in that particular area. Although there are exceptions to this rule, these attributes describe men and women as a whole. The Gemara therefore tells us that, like the sun and the moon, man and woman were originally created equal, but that woman's light was subsequently lessened. According to the sages, light refers to Torah. 5. The Megillah 16b states, Ora zu Torah. Light is Torah. And we are also told, Ein or Ela Torah. Light refers only to Torah. Hasidic sources say that the Or HaGanuz, the hidden light, the light of the first day of creation, was hidden in the Torah, and those who merit it can find it there even today. In messianic times, this light will be revealed to all. Right? Were you aware of that concept?
Yeah. Or HaGanuz in the Torah? That has to do a lot with also the husks, that we have this light that will be revealed.
What I'm saying is that the Torah, that when the world was first created, there was that first light when God said, Vayihi Or, the light was too big for this world. So it was hidden.
Yeah.
But one of the places that it was hidden is in the Torah. And anybody who has the capacity to study it in a certain way, if they've made themselves into a receptacle for it, could access that light today. They don't have to wait for messianic time.
I'm not saying I access the light.
I'm just telling you that that's the thing, that we can prepare ourselves. That's what mitzvahs are about. That if we behave in a certain way physically, we transform our receiving vessel, so that we can then access it. But it's only by becoming the right kli. It's only by becoming the right receiver, the vessel. Yeah.
You see light, or do you have a deeper understanding of what you're learning?
You have that deeper understanding, but I would say, like, even like my tiny little experience today of humming that song and having the mitzvah and it connecting, it was like a little piece of light shining through. It was like, for me, it was so exciting. It was just like, there are little rays that come, you know, when you're in a place. And I'm not saying I've achieved a high place at all. I mean, my piece of light came from a folk song, right? So like, that's a low place. And yet, the more you love it, the more you study it and keep mitzvahs. I have to just reiterate that, because it comes with behaving in a way that transforms you. If you behave in a way that transforms you, you can access chunks of light, that flow that you get. But it has to do with how you transform yourself so that you can access them. And then the learning. You have to do both. Right? You have to expose yourself to it, and you have to be able to receive it. Let's see.
Just finish up that.
Right, the Gemara therefore tells us, right, like that, like the sun and the moon, men and women came created equally, and the woman's light was subsequently lessened. According to the sages, light refers to Torah. The Mishnah Brura says that the diminution of the moon was caused by the sin of Chava, Eve. Therefore, before we can discuss the Midrash, we must first understand Chava's sin and its ramifications throughout world history, which we should start with next time, because it's much too much. Yes. Yes, so that's where we'll leave us on the cliffhanger of what did Chava do and how does it impact on us today?
So just back up a little bit. The diminishing of the moonlight has to do something with
Chava's sin, right? So man and women were created equally, and then right after the creation, we have Chava engaged in a very negative behavior, which we'll discuss next time.
But didn't precede the creation of the moon, preceded the Adam story?
Yes, so it did. That's why we're saying it's not literal, right? That this whole story is not about why the moon is smaller. That hidden inside the verse is a piece of light that you could get if you could get it. Mm-hmm. So this is putting a magnifying glass on that verse so that we could see the Midrash, so that we could see further, so that we could see further. But in order to see it, we have to first get more information. So it's not about the timeline.
Right. Or maybe because everything was already known.
Absolutely. It is because everything was already known. So that's why it's just planted in that verse. But it's not about this happened first and then that happened. It is about the diminution of the feminine. Why was it diminished? So we're going to see Chava's sin. And then we're going to see what happens, how that played out through history, or is playing out through history, and what changes will happen because of it, how it will be fixed, etc. But first, so we're going to leave ourselves with what did Chava do, and what difference did it make?
Interesting.
But not for 2 more weeks, right?
Not for 2 more weeks.
I can read the book. I can find it.